Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, a show where we discuss the news with people from around the world. This is episode number 56 for May 2015. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. If this is the first time you're listening to the show, I will explain in 20 seconds what it is. We get people from different countries, different cultures, different regions of the world to tell us how they saw the news from the past month. And we get, hopefully, a different color for our opinions and sort of a different side, another side of all the stories that we think we've already figured out. That was more than 20 seconds, I think. But it's okay, because today is going to be an awesome show, and it's worth spending the time that's needed to make it cool. I have, of course, with me, as I do most episodes, my partner in crime, Turkey from Saudi Arabia. How's it going?
Hey, Patrick. I don't like you at the moment, so we're not friends.
I think you don't like me most moments, but I'm very curious and eager to know why at this specific moment you don't like me.
You're traveling. I had to cancel my trip, so I'm not a big fan of you.
Yeah, you were supposed to travel and you weren't going to be in Riyadh today. What happened?
Something came up. I had to cancel. So I have 2 weeks vacation and I'm stuck in Riyadh.
Well, it's a staycation. You can play video games. It's fun too.
Well,
right?
I'm playing The Witcher. So yeah.
There you go. Very fun. Yeah. All right. Well, there was a chance you couldn't make it if you had to travel, and now you are here. So I am happy about the fact that your vacation got ruined. So
yeah, you're just some selfish French guy. No problem.
You're used to it by now, so it's okay. We also have on the show Mahmoud, who's back from a few months ago. And Mahmoud is joining us from Dubai. How is it going, sir?
It's going good.
Yeah?
It's fine. Can't complain at the moment, yeah.
Okay, excellent, excellent. I'm very glad to have you back. You know, I'll say something that is going to sound silly, but I'm going to say it anyway, because this show is also about a little bit of honesty. I usually try to avoid getting people. It was sort of my policy to think, well, if we get someone from the Middle East or from an Arab country, it's okay. Maybe we don't need two people on the same show. But it's like, I get people from different countries in Europe all the time. There's no reason, you know, the Arab countries are as diverse as countries in Europe or anywhere else. So yeah. I figured, you know what? It will be interesting, I think, to have Mahmoud and Turkey at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's great, Danny. I don't think we're all the same, like most people think.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's the point, yeah. And hopefully, so now you have to basically disagree with each other vehemently on everything, or I'll be disappointed.
Well, I'll try my best.
Did you say Yanni?
Did I say that?
I think so.
Yeah, it sometimes slips in. It sometimes slips in, sorry.
Oh, it's so cool, because, you know, I get to understand a little bit of Arabic that, the little bit I remember. And finally, I was saying we have people from different countries in Europe. We have a guest from the better country in Europe, from Sweden. Brekki is here with us today. How's it going, Brekki?
It's going great. It's been a lovely day here. So I've been outside most of the day and just came indoors for this and then heading back outside again.
Ah, well, it's nice that we can get you away from the very harmful sun and indoors for just a little bit.
Well, I say nice, but you know, this is Sweden we're talking about, so it's still mostly cloudy.
Well, fair enough. You've never been on the show, I think.
No, I have not.
Ah, that, well, we'll hear a little bit more about what you do on a regular basis, because you are a very prolific podcaster, and we'll get to hear what you do aside from this show at the end of this at the end of the show. But yeah, I was seeing the better country of Sweden. It's definitely, for those who don't know, the idea that Nordic countries and Scandinavia has the best track record in basically everything, be it education, wealth, comfort, everything, health. And I'm experiencing this as I'm now, as people know, I'm married to a Finn, and I travel to the Nordic countries here and there. And yeah, I get to experience the fact that it's weird when you go there and you realize how everything works perfectly, and then you come back here and you're like, why are we not copying what they're doing again? What is this madness? So yeah. Anyway, do you agree? Is this something that you feel from Scandinavia, or is it like the silly southerners that think everything's good, but in fact, it isn't?
I agree mostly. I mean, the Scandinavian countries have a fairly high standard in most things, but every single one has these weird outliers. Like Sweden, for example, our education system is really bad at the moment and has been, you know, dropping for the past 10 years. Mm. Then we have other countries like in Denmark, where they have a really bad financial situation right now, which nobody ever really speaks about. Then there's Finland with the you know, absurdly high suicide ratio. And then there's Norway, which has a lot of Norwegian people.
You are from Norway initially, aren't you?
No, I'm from Iceland.
Iceland. Originally. Oh, right. Of course. You were berating me when I was saying I'm now learning Swedish and starting to speak Swedish. You were telling me that I should learn Icelandic next.
Yeah, because I mean, there's 400,000 people on Earth that speak Icelandic. And right. Imagine all these people who you're missing out on talking to.
It's kind of like, if you can increase the number of people that speak Icelandic by one, it's an enormous effect on your country of origin's language. So, and Icelandic is also one of those Scandinavian countries. Is it considered Scandinavia? Not really. It's off to the side.
No,
right?
it's considered Nordic. Scandinavia is only, like, you know, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark.
And Denmark.
Yeah, Finland and the Faroe Islands and Iceland are the Nordic countries in addition to Scandinavia. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's this weird little country on the side where I think I mentioned this at least once every episode, the fact that you have an app in Iceland to check if you're a cousin with someone when you're in Reykjavik and you have a few drinks and you want to hook up. You have an app to check if you're cousins. And so, because everyone is so closely related, you're never sure if someone is your cousin, even when you meet randomly. I hope this is not an urban legend.
No, it's absolutely true. Yeah. And this has been going on, you know, even before it was an app. People interested in genealogy, we just sit down and say, oh, so who are you and where are you from? Oh, okay, you're from that place. Let me see. My second cousin is from there. Do you know a guy called this? Yeah, he's a neighbor to this guy. Okay, are they related? Yeah, well, they share the same grandfather. So, okay, so we're related that way. I mean, I even sat down and figured out how I'm related to Björk, the singer.
Oh, wow. So how far are you from Björk?
We have an ancestor in common in the late 1700s.
Oh, so that's kind of far. It's seven kind of generations disappointed, away. I have to say. Yeah,
seven generations away.
All right, let's get into the show proper. I was kind of saying I was going to try and keep it on the shorter side, but that's not not starting very well.
Patrick is just clear right now that your wife trained you well.
Trained me well in what?
And being.
Oh, right. Okay, thank you. Count on Turkey to make it lewd.
I was just trying to figure out what to say to make it lewd, but he beat it to me.
All right. Let's start, as always, with me. Woohoo.
It's not all about you, Patrick. Come on.
Isn't it? You want to start, Turkey?
No, I have depressing, so you can start.
Oh. Okay, well, I don't think it's quite on the happy side either, but it's at least my first story is kind of a little bit funny in the sense that it's ridiculous and depressing, so it's funny, right? In that kind of humor. You were talking about education, Brecky, earlier, and it's been a heavily debated topic of discussion in France for a while. And now there is an education reform that is being discussed. The government wants to implement it. And it targets specifically what we call college, or in French, collège, which is essentially junior high school. It's from the ages of 12 to 16, I believe, 12 to 15, more or less. And there is an education reform, which honestly, I'm not going to go into the details of, because it's not even quite very clear what they want to do and what they don't want to do. There are debates on between the left and the right, and even internally on the left, on whether or not it's good or not good. There are two points which I think will be interesting to discuss, because they are the salient ones. And quite by accident, they fit the theme of this show. But one is the idea that they're going to get rid of bilingual classes and bilingual courses, meaning that you would not have to learn a third language. And because today you have to learn two additional languages, and you have the choice usually between English, Spanish, and German. Most of the people take English as a second language, and then take Spanish or German as a third language. And then you have some people that take Italian, or even I don't know if you call them the dead languages in English, but Latin, and not Greek, but at least Latin. So it's not that they want to make them irrelevant, but there are less people. There would be more choice, basically, after the reform. And the irony in this is that even when you do learn English, you only get 2 hours of English a week for your second language. And it does start earlier in your education now, but it's still like in junior high or high school, you essentially get 2 hours of English. And honestly, how much English can you learn? Already learning at school is not very efficient, I think, but if it's only 2 hours a week, it's kind of ridiculous. And the other one is, there was one controversy about the idea. Some people were saying they are going to replace teaching about Christianity and Judaism with teaching about Islam, which is actually not the case. They want to include Islam in the teaching in a historical context, because France is still very much attached to the idea of the secular teaching without religion. How do you call this?
Secular, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Secular atheistic view on college, at least. You don't teach religion as such. It's more about history of and context. And I personally think it's very important that we learn about Islam, because a lot of it won't come as a surprise for most of the listeners, but I think the being unfamiliar with something leads to a lot more animosity and defiance towards something. So of course, Islam being such an important thing in the world right now, I think it's important that we know that we have someone, an authority figure, telling us how it came to be and what is factual about Islam, rather than hearing it from someone else who might be less reliable. But that was also a topic of contention, because people were saying, well, we don't, not everyone, but it's like, well, we don't want to replace our cultural heritage with Islam. What is this? And like immigrants and horror and fear. And that was, it's not like it was a lot of people, but it did come up, and it is reflective of some portions of the population's the way they regard this whole issue. And as a last note, I want to say that in our educational system, we usually have over 10 different things that we learn. You know, there are 10 different topics that we have to learn about. You know, it's French language, math, physics, biology, physics and chemistry are together. Two additional languages, philosophy when you get into later stages, sports, and a bunch of others, two or three others. And it seems very difficult to learn everything well. And in other countries, it seems it's a little bit more focused. So you learn less things, but and you get to choose. In the UK, for example, I believe you get to choose the things you're going to learn about, but you do less. You do maybe four or five. And so, yeah, that is the main topic of discussion in France today. I was wondering, maybe, Brecky, you were talking about education. Do you see any similarities with the way education is regarded in Sweden? Or is it does that what we do seem dumb? Or I don't know.
It doesn't seem dumb at all, no. One of my sticking points when it comes to education is, especially here in the more socialist European countries, so to speak, there's often this idea that government or teacher plans and so on are set up so that everybody should learn the exact same thing at the same tempo. So the government has already decided that, you know, everybody should know these seven subjects. And when they're in first year, they should learn this group of things. When they're in second year, they should learn this group of things. There's rarely any space given to individuality. Maybe somebody's really good at speaking English, but they're really poor at math. So even though they're in fourth grade, maybe they're doing English at a seventh grade level, but math at a second grade level. And there's never really any space given for that kind of individuality. And it doesn't seem like this French suggestion is opening up for that kind of thing either. It's just basically saying, you know, these things about language, for example, and just slightly shifting the focus when it comes to religious studies by just adding another group of religions to add in the group.
It's definitely something that is very prevalent in France in education, but also in most things. It's this top-down idea that the state is going to provide stuff for, you know, it's the republic that is going to provide for its pupils, kind of, its people. And everyone, you know, it's kind of one size fits all, but it's everyone is going to get everything they need. And of course, it doesn't really work when people have individual needs, but it's also obviously a lot more difficult and costly to create systems where you can adapt to people's needs, and especially for students. Of course, it's a very important thing, but it's very difficult to do. So
yeah.
I guess it's the same. How about you guys in you know, in the Arabian world over there in the East, which is very uniform, and obviously everything is the same for all of you guys.
Are you talking about where they actually teach you religion in school as mandatory?
I guess. So, yeah.
I really don't know what you expect us to say.
Well, so let's start with you, Turkey, then. How is education, you know, looked at and regarded? Is it monolithic? Do you just have everyone has the same education? Is it I don't know. I have no idea. How a kid who goes to school in Saudi Arabia, what they learn.
Yeah, well, basically, at least in all the public schools, it's the same education system, exactly the same. After all, the books are printed and distributed by the government, so. And that's also private schools for Saudis. They are required. They use the same books. The only exception in private schools, they might have an extra one or two classes that cover subjects that are not covered by the government books. So, and religion is a major part of that. So I can't remember exactly. I think there's five or six subjects or topics that you study every year, which are basically religious.
Hmm.
So it's unified here.
So, for example, could you give me one example of a religious topic that you study?
Well, you have, I give you, for example, we have the Quran. So they study the Holy Quran. They study what we call fiqh, which is basically the study of religion in life and how to live and perform different religious acts. We have tafsir, which is the translation or explanation of the Holy book, the Quran, and so on. So you have all of these different religious books, and it's part of studying here. It's a mandatory. Right. So
obviously, Islam is the official religion of Saudi Arabia, and it's mandatory. So I'm guessing it's taught.
So the only religion in Saudi Arabia, the only recognized religion.
Of course. So I'm guessing it's being taught as not as this is what the book says, but this is what you should do, right? This is how you should approach it.
It depends. You have the Quran, which is basically they just teach them reading it and memorizing it. Then you have the translation, which is an explanation of the meanings of the Quran. There's the book from the government, but some teachers would have their different explanations from time to time, depending on the class and so on. But within the school, it's unified. Outside the schools, then you have different ways of explaining and translating the meanings.
Mm.
So just out of curiosity, by the way, I assume that the teachings and so on, that they're all focused on the Wahhabi perspective. I mean, there's never any, you know, this is what we believe, but then this is what the Shia believe, and this is what other Sunni groups believe.
Shia, definitely not. We never teach them about Shia because we don't, Sunnis at least don't recognize the Shias.
Of course.
Do you mention them even? Is it like, well, those guys, they follow this dude and...
As far as, if my memory serves me right, I don't remember ever them being mentioned because it's a sensitive topic. There's about 5-10% of the population are Shiites, mostly in the Eastern Province. So it's not something we would promote in school to explain their belief system since we don't recognize it officially, but we rather not try to encourage people to dislike them too much, at least not within the school system.
So it's not like they're wrong, they should, you know, change.
No, not in official books, no.
Okay.
Not in official religious books within the school system.
What about other religions? Are they mentioned at all, or is it the same kind
of... they are... only two religions are mentioned, which are Christianity and Judaism. And they are mentioned, not in too much detail, just basic information, because Islam is based on... Islam does believe that Judaism and Christianity were our religions that were part of Islam. They were brought by God through their prophets. However, they are no more recognized. Islam came in to replace those religions. So they teach about Islam, Christianity and Judaism as that from that point of view.
Of course. What about other topics like science and literature and...
Maybe
science specifically. Do you? I'm sure you learn basic math and physics and.
Yeah. We have there's math, geology.
So
types of science.
Yeah, and how far is school mandatory, and how far do Saudis usually go? How old do they are they when they stop going to school? Is it, you know,
school,
high school, university, or
it is not mandatory
at all?
At all, it's not mandatory in Saudi. However, the society here, they usually force their children to go to school. So I would think at least 90% or more do end up going at least through the first 6 grades for sure. But usually most Saudis do finish the 12 grades.
12 grades meaning until they're 18, right?
Until they're 18 before college. So that's the last. The majority, at least, I believe. So if I would put an estimate, definitely 60 to 70% do that.
Mm.
A lot more finish at least until 6th grade.
Okay. All right. Mahmoud, as per our agreement at the beginning of the show, you're going to disagree with everything and it's going to be completely different. Right? I guess we should say... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, it is a bit different. It's not
cool.
In Jordan, it's not the same as in Saudi Arabia.
Right. I said you're from Dubai, but you're currently living in Dubai.
You're originally from Dubai. Yeah, I'm Jordanian. My nationality is Jordanian. But in Jordan, school is definitely mandatory for everybody till high school, 12 years. It's not optional to not send your kids to school. So you have to. And when it comes to the religious studies, we had, as far as I can remember, only one subject and one class about religion, which is Islam, of course. But it wasn't only historical, but it had some theological aspects, like Turkey said, in about what happens in Saudi Arabia. But the rest of the curriculum and the classes are pretty much the same, like math, geology, biology, all of that stuff.
Okay. So, and it's mandatory, so everyone...
Yeah, it's definitely mandatory. You cannot not send your kids to school. You have to.
Of course. Mm. So it's less...
I just wanted to mention when you ask about whether they teach about other sects, about Sunnis. And we do cover Sunni. You said Wahhabism. Well, it depends on who you talk to. Most people here don't recognize that word, Wahhabism.
No. Exactly. I didn't know the word Wahhabi until a few years ago. Yeah. I've never heard it before. Yeah.
Yeah, Wahhabism is more of a word that was invented by the Western media.
Sure. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Islam, the Sunni Islam, is basically divided into four major sects, or four books and four fiqhs. Which is four teachings, different teachings. We have the Hanbali, the Hanafi, the Maliki, and the Shafi'i. Mm-hmm. Saudi mostly follows the concept of Hanbali concept. There are some people who follow Hanafi and Maliki. And in the books here, mostly what we teach is Hanbali. And that's what some people would call Wahhabism in some parts of the world. And that's what we majorly teach. But we also do cover the other teachings of these four books, because we recognize all four teachings as part of the Sunni Islam movement. Mm.
And so the word Wahhabi Islam is not something that is commonly used at all.
No, it's almost never used. It's okay. Used by extremists, from left-wing extremists mostly, and Western media. So if you in Saudi... Yeah. The only Saudis here would use it are usually left-wing liberals who would adopt the Western media concept of Wahhabism. But mostly here...
Can you define left-wing extremists in the context of Saudi Arabia? Because here it's communists, so...
Here are extreme liberalists.
Okay. So secular, basically.
Yeah, secular and liberal and so on, so... There are some of them who are extreme, and those are the ones who would use the word Wahhabism mostly.
All right.
Which were the four directions, you say? Because I've always heard them as five different.
No, in Sunni Islam, there's four basic teachings. You have the Hanbali teaching, which is major, basically what Saudi follows. Mm-hmm. You have the Hanafi teaching, and you have the Maliki and the Shafi'i. So those are the four major teachings of Sunni Islam.
Okay, isn't there a Zahiri?
There are a few other smaller ones, and those are more modern teachings. Okay. But the four major teachings that you would find in almost all the Islamic world are these four.
Okay.
You know, I think one day we will have to do a show on this alone, on just trying to discuss. It's such foreign to at least to me, I think it would be very, very interesting to dive a little bit into this.
I studied Islam at the university for 1 year because it was just so foreign to me. So I decided that, you know, this is something that I need to learn more about.
Yeah, the problem is, especially with the Western media, Islam is Islam, Wahhabism, and terrorist.
That's
Shias. Sunnis and Shias, they don't do anything beyond those concepts. So that's what people know.
All right, so let me turn the table on you, on both of you, basically, Mahmoud and Turkey. Do you guys differentiate the you know, Christianity with all its different currents and I don't even know how to call them, sects and religions? You know, do you know about the difference between, you know, Protestants? Is it Protestants that you say?
Protestants.
And like, do the average people know about all of this? Or
well, in Saudi, most people only know Christianity,
right? As a whole, it's just for us, you know, Islam.
And a few would know the difference between a Catholic and an Orthodox Christian belief, but other than that, most people wouldn't know. Except for the highly educated people who've been abroad and so on.
Okay, so it's not that, you know, it's not that surprising that we wouldn't know about the different between the different...
Well, in Jordan, people actually do know the difference because we have somewhat of a large Christian community, and they all fall into different sects, if you will. Yeah. So we can't differentiate to an extent. And and school, actually, if I remember correctly, we learned the history about of Christianity and the split between the Catholic Church and Protestant Protestant Church and Lutherans and people like that. Yeah.
You know, it seems so silly that we wouldn't, you know, learn the about a minimum about the three big monotheistic religions and a few others. I'm not saying we should learn in detail about everything that there is to know, because you could, you know, lose yourself for years in all of this. And people do, you know, theology is a very complex topic. But
I spent 4 years at the university studying nothing but religion.
Oh, well, there you go. I didn't realize. You're a theologian.
Pretty much.
Interesting. All right. Well, in that case, I will defer to you whenever I have any question about anything that has to do with religion.
You do that.
All right. Another topic I wanted to discuss very briefly, much more briefly than this one, is the pressing question of ISIS and in Syria and Iraq, and the fact that they seem to be gaining terrain and territories, and we as the West can't seem to be stopping them. That is sort of established already. But the big question that poses is, especially in Syria, what do we do? What do we as Westerners do once they get to Damascus, which seems more and more likely now? Because obviously we're not very big fans of Assad, and we're not at all very big fans of ISIS and the Islamic State, even though now they have the moderates that are against Assad that have allied with the extremists, the religious extremists of ISIS. And we're hearing, you know, stories about how they steal the works of art and then funnel them outside the countries and get them bought by other, by Westerners. And this is one of the ways they fund their war efforts. And it's not the only thing, of course. They have more traditional means as well. But anyway, the big question is, what do we do once they get to Damascus? Do we support Assad, which, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but, or do we, what do we do?
Well, the question is, what moderates are joining ISIS?
Well, that's what we're hearing. We're hearing that the
moderates would never.
I'm telling you what we're hearing.
I'm telling you, moderates would never join ISIS. They would rather join Assad than ISIS, because ISIS is worse to them than Assad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. that would never happen. Moderates would never join ISIS. ISIS is just people who are walking around and discriminate people just by what you believe in. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So I really them reaching Damascus, I really doubt it. They wouldn't be able to get to Damascus. They are powerful. They are doing a lot of stuff, and they're taking over a lot of parts of the country. But Damascus is not an easy target, and I really don't think it's going to get to that point.
Well, I don't think anyone's thinking they're going to, you know, take Damascus. But what people are thinking is it's going to get to a point where Damascus is going to have to fight. They're going to be not at the doors, but close, and it's going to be defending Damascus. And you're saying, there's no way it's not going to be a battle. It's not even going to be a battle.
Yeah, Patrick, let's be honest. The only reason ISIS exists and it's moving and it's taking control is thanks to the West and all the Arab countries. We are the ones who created this environment for them. We are the ones who allowed them to exist. We are the ones who are allowing them to expand.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about this. Allowing them to expand, as always, as, you know, for every single issue we've had like this, those groups were created initially with the help of the West. I don't think there's a single time that this happened without our involvement. But the question remains, you know, for us. And you're saying, Turkey, it's overblown? Is that what you're saying? It's not going to come to that?
If it ever comes to that, then I think people will take things seriously then. the entire world would take it seriously at that moment. And that's when I expect actual ground troops would move in.
Okay. Mahmoud, what is the your and yours view on all of this?
Well, they've already taken over half of Syria. So it's kind of ridiculous to ask what we're going to do if they take off Damascus. They already have half of Syria and a large portion of Iraq. And recently, like 2 days ago, they took over a new city in Iraq called Ramadi, which is on the Iraqi-Jordanian border. So that question is a bit late to ask. Now, if we want to stop them, we should have stopped them a long time ago.
But so how do we do it, though? Do you, because then that's
boots on the ground. Boots on the ground. That's the only solution. Yeah. You need armies to get involved in this. Airstrikes do absolutely nothing to them.
Yeah, because we've been doing for months now. But so your estimation, Mahmoud, is that at least Jordan would welcome, not per se American troops, but NATO troops on the ground in I guess you're concerned with it.
Look, if you want the government would welcome that, I think they would welcome that. But do the people welcome that? They will, even if they would welcome it, they will never admit it in public. And as far as getting the Jordanian army involved, that's off the limits right now. Like, the Jordanians are not up for that.
No. It's strange, though, because, I mean, once you're looking at the map, I mean, you've got Syria and Iraq in big trouble right now. And then you have these three countries that are historical enemies of each other, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. But they should all have a vested interest in trying to keep the Islamic State as small as possible. But are they just waiting for their own sovereign nation to be threatened, or are they just fine with Syria and Iraq going under?
No. That's basically, these three countries have an unstable Iraq and Syria, because an unstable Iraq and Syria is actually beneficial for these three countries. So unless they are threatened directly, they don't really care that much.
Iran has been very active in Iraq. I mean, there's a number of Shiite militia groups from Iran.
Yeah.
Currently combating ISIS.
They are, and that's why they are combating ISIS, because they were able to establish these militias and these Shiite militias. So they have an agenda where they are actually moving in and slowly taking over the government of Iraq. And that's what they need. For Israel, Israel is just waiting until ISIS gets to its border. For it, an unstable enemy country is better than a stable enemy country. So let them fight it. If they reach our border, then we'll react for that.
I guess what is the impression that we have here in France over the past few weeks is that we've reached that, or we're almost at that point where it is becoming an issue, where it's not just instability or unrest. It's to the point where ISIS and the Islamic State should be a concern for us. But what you're saying is that we're not there yet. Turkey.
Is it a threat right now? No. Is it a problem? Yes.
Okay.
Is it a big headache? Is it giving us a little some headaches? Is it making some small threats within the countries? Yes, they are. Is it a major threat that we would need to move forward and just demolish it? No. Right now, it's beneficial for Iran. It's beneficial for Israel. It's beneficial for Saudi Arabia that they exist. Until they become a big threat. And it's beneficial even for Turkey. And that's another major country that's infected by this. They are all benefiting from this.
So let me ask you then this question to try and summarize in one word whether or not we have a similar view on this. Is it because in here in France there is a whiff of panic? And I'm wondering if that word panic applies for the way you guys as countries regard this situation yet, or is it not there yet? For me, I would say yes, there is a whiff of panic. Brecky.
To a certain extent. I mean, ISIS has been in the news quite a lot here in Sweden of late because there's a lot of Swedish people traveling down to Syria to join the fight at the moment. I think out of the Nordic, or at least the Western European countries, Sweden has one of the highest in terms of, you know, percentage of population traveling down there. We have a large...
You mean to fight in the ISIS army,
yes,
right?
To fight with them, yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's even been a lot of talk here from the government for how to help people who decide that this maybe wasn't a good idea, how to, you know, reintegrate them into society and help them to apartments and jobs and so on, which I personally might, you know, find a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mahmoud, obviously you have a very large border with Syria, is it?
Syria, Israel, and Saudi Arabia and Iraq. So
panic or not panic yet?
Panic. In March.
I said Yanni again.
Okay.
It's fine.
That's the second time. Start a count for it. Now, back a few months ago, if you remember, there was a Jordanian pilot who was shot down over Syria by ISIS, and he was executed. They burned him alive. So at that point, at that time, yes, there was panic about from the public in Jordan about what are we going to do about ISIS. And they seemed like a very real threat, because they got a Jordanian citizen and they killed him in front of everybody. But now it's not really a direct threat. It's not something that is pressing on everybody's mind. But I agree with Turkey that it's a problem for the West, but I don't agree that it's still a problem. I think it's a threat to us here in the region, for Jordan and Syria and Saudi Arabia, because ISIS is not just in Syria. And the threat is not just ISIS. There is ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And Iraq, you have the Shia faction and you have the Sunni tribes. And in Syria itself, you have different faction other than ISIS. So I do believe it's a threat. And just yesterday, a bombing in a mosque in Saudi Arabia, four people were killed. Before that, another bombing on a border checkpoint for the Saudi forces. People, also officers got killed. So it is a direct threat for the countries around. People are getting killed, even if it's 5 or 6 or 7. And these countries are stable countries. They're not used to this. So I do think it's a threat for us.
It seems more pressing for Jordan, for sure.
Yeah, and just to go back to a point you were talking about how Israel, Jordan, Iraq, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, and Qatar also is involved in this, and UAE is involved in this. Historically, the Arab countries, how they handle this situation, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when the Palestinian resistance was outside of Palestine, mainly in Jordan, Lebanon, and sometimes in Syria. If you look at the history of these Palestinian resistant factions, there were so many factions. You had Fatah, you had the Democratic Front, and a lot other. And each faction was supported by a foreign Arab country. Like Syria supported this faction, Iraq supported this faction, Saudi Arabia supported this faction. And I think that's what's happening right now on the ground regarding ISIS and other factions is exactly what was happening back then. Every country is invested in one faction and trying to push it to take over the other factions that are supported by other countries. Mm. And the Qatari influence is a big influence in the area right now. And it should not be discarded as a non-player in this whole mess. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. As always, we could spend a lot of time on all of this, but let's move on and turn our gaze back to the amazing Turkey for what has been making the news in his corner of the world.
Well, it's not good news, which is Mohammed just mentioned yesterday. A so-called ISIS bomber, suicide bomber, had went into a Shiite mosque in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia during Friday prayers and blew himself up. That resulted in 21 dead and 109 injured. And so, this is the biggest news right now. And so it's happened yesterday and everybody is up at arms on it.
So I guess it might be interesting for some of us that it might come as news for some of us that you are also the victims of terrorism.
We've always been a victim of terrorism. We've had terrorist attacks in Saudi as far as, I don't remember, my memory goes as far as 1995 or before even. So we've always had terrorist attacks here on occasions, but this one is a big deal. It's a sectarian attack. We haven't had that. A lot of those, those are very rare. The last one we had a few months ago, and this is a big major one, and it's really making the government nervous. It's and the fact that it's an ISIS claiming responsibility is also making people nervous and worried about it.
Well, I guess we talked about ISIS quite a bit just before, so we will not spend too much time on it. But I'm curious on to know what sociological effects this has. You know, what different people think of it, what people say, and when you're saying it's making the government and other people nervous, in what way?
It's because it's a sectarian attack. It's really making things a little nervous. Sunnis and Shias have never been very good friends, and they disagree on a lot. And Saudi is no exception, of course, to that. And this attack has brought out different point of views and ways of thinking to the surface from the reactions of the major population. A lot of people have condemned this and are supporting the government and the Shias population and protecting them and supporting them and so on. However, there is a very good percentage of people who came online and those who actually said, what did you expect? That's what Shias deserve. There's others who said, yeah, we need to do more of that. The Shias are our enemies. So you have, this is where the government is really nervous. They really don't need a sectarian war being started in Saudi. They are already having enough problem trying to control the sectarian problem with their war in Yemen, and they really don't need it to be part of local domestic problems.
Okay. Very quickly around the table, the virtual thousands of kilometers spanning table, I don't think it wasn't mentioned, it didn't become a big deal. Maybe it's too early, but it didn't make front page news in France. I'm curious, what about Sweden? Did it?
No, not at all.
Okay. Jordan /
UAE. Yeah, it definitely made in the news here. It's a big deal over here, yeah. But yeah. I was surprised when I saw the news. I thought it's the Houthis, not ISIS. That's what I thought at first until I read the news itself and it said ISIS. So it came from nowhere.
Okay.
The Houthis the Houthis are the Yemeni group that the Saudi government is fighting, and the Houthis would not have enough power to extend all the way to the eastern province. So nobody expected them, but people did expect it to be some extremists. It's just that they are ISIS extremists. That's where things are worried. And the government of Saudi Arabia actually, I think it was less than a month ago, arrested 65 suspects who are part of ISIS in Saudi who are planning to do some bombing. So that's also another thing that's making the government nervous, because they should have caught them all. And apparently there were still some of them out there.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's really sad. Seriously, I really, and I've said this before, I don't understand how any human being would have this mentality of attacking and blowing up people, let alone people who are praying in a mosque or in a church or in a synagogue or any house of worship, people who are just there to pray, that you would go in and blow yourself up and kill so many of them.
I'll let that linger as we move on to the other topic that Mahmoud is going to bring for us.
Yeah, well, in Jordan, about a week ago, there was a major shift in the security scene. The Minister of Interior resigned. They say resigned, but he was,
sacked.
Told to resign. And the director of the public security department also was sacked, and the director of the gendarme over there also resigned, or sacked, actually. And this came as a surprise to everybody. It made all the headlines everywhere in every newspaper and all the news bulletins. And the reason they gave that there was a lack of cooperation between these three departments regarding interior security. And people are a bit hesitant to believe this. Like, we all, you know, the lack of people always know that there is a lack of cooperation. Well, any government over here, government operations, is well known for its bureaucracy and corruption sometimes. But you know, this came out of, let's say, as they say, out of the left field. Nobody expected this. Mm. And then the big news for me is the new Ministry of Interior, which is a new old one, because back in mid-90s, he was also the Security of Interior for two terms, if I remember correctly. And he wasn't well known for his, let's say, soft touch with the people. And at his time, the intelligence agency had more power than ever, and the freedom of the press was at its lowest point. And at that time also, the peace treaty between Jordan and Israel was signed. So, and he's now 79. So people are really, really afraid of why is he back. Is there something that's going to happen more than like a decrease in freedoms than already is, or they just don't know? We have to wait and see.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the context for all of this, meaning how much freedom, and I'm sorry for putting it this way, but I'm trying to put it in terms that everyone, including myself, would understand.
Yeah.
How Western is Jordan? Well, in the sense of, you know, freedom of the press, freedom of expression.
Okay, if we're talking about public freedoms, like freedoms to organize and rally and demonstrate and freedom of press, it's not that free. It's definitely in a third world category. But back in the early 90s, when martial law was lifted and democracy officially started in Jordan, up till 94, there was a huge boom in, let's say, freedom of the press and media and comedians, and it was very similar to what would you see in the West. Like, they made fun of the king and other Arab leaders and world leaders freely and openly, and even the king used to go and attend these events. That lasted for about 4 years, up until the peace treaty with Israel was signed, and this guy was the Minister of Interior Affairs. So It was very short-lived. Now it's just typical Arab world, typical third world country freedom, if you will.
Okay. And so the fact that this guy is coming back, is people are afraid it will go even farther in restricting freedoms, or?
Sorry, I didn't...
The security official coming back is getting people afraid that... They will, you know,
yeah,
things
that
will...
we will see a more decline in the already low freedom tolerance of the government. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. That's, you know, it's very weird to think that it's kind of a weird dichotomy where I will think, well, are you fighting for it, or are you for it, or are you not for it, or what's happening? I don't know. It's weird to
you as the Jordanians, or you as me, Mahmoud.
No, you as Jordania as a country, as a country.
Yeah, Jordan. I know. I don't think like Jordan. Jordanians will not voice a harsh opinion. They will not go out to the streets to say we're not happy with this guy. They're going to stay silent, and he will be the next Minister of Interior for whatever time the king chooses for him to stay in that position. But people talk, journalists write, so whether it's for it or against it, people still voice their opinion, but it's not going to be heard, and they don't expect it to be heard.
Okay.
Just out of interest, the United Nations Development Program puts out a yearly report called the Human Development Report, which is basically they're analyzing things like press freedoms and so on in various countries. And Jordan is in the 77th place on that list, following Iran and Azerbaijan, but coming ahead of Serbia, Brazil, and Georgia.
Yeah.
Norway is a number one.
You had to sneak it in there, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, Sweden is 12, so I had to say another Scandinavian country.
All right. Anything else?
France is 20, by the way.
Oh, that's... Wow.
You know, still in the top 50, which is good.
Yeah, but yeah. this is before the Internet Security Act that
the mass surveillance thing.
Yeah.
This is before that. So
yeah, this is last year. So
yeah,
the next Human Development Index is coming out this fall.
All right, we'll be following this very closely. I think our ranking might change a little bit.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. All right. Okay, Mahmoud, anything else?
I have one more story from local UAE, which I found very interesting regarding the development today that happened. Basically, the story is a few months ago, or maybe a year, I'm not sure, five Qatari nationals, intelligence officers, were caught and imprisoned. One or two actually were caught and imprisoned. The others remain at large. And they faced a trial for organizing a social media campaign to insult and defame the leaders of UAE. Yesterday or the day before, the court ruled life sentences for four of them and 10-year sentence for one of them, which the one in detention got 10 years and the people at large got life in prison. That was very interesting when it came out. But today, all the news headlines said that basically the president of UAE, Sheikh Khalifa, has pardoned two of them, including the one that is in custody, and he's free to go home, which is just came out of nowhere. Like, these people were sentenced by the security court, which is a military court. Life sentences, 10 years for this guy, and today the sheikh just pardoned them, free to go.
So why? Him. What happened?
They say it's because they want to keep the brotherhood ties with Qatar, because Qatar is another Gulf country, and back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, when the UAE was formed, they were offered to be part of the UAE, but they refused along with Bahrain. So in this sense that we are going to keep good relations with our brothers in Qatar, they're free to go. That's it.
Okay.
So it was very interesting to see that.
Wow. Yeah. So then in that case, how do people react to it? Is it like, oh, well, you know, he can do whatever he wants, fine. Well, but the law is the law. They decided that.
Yeah. Well, actually, today is holiday, so I'm at home all day. I haven't talked to anybody. this came out today, this pardon news. But from what I've seen on the comments on the websites, the news websites, that people are just glad they're praising the president for this act of compassion. And they seem to be happy about it.
Okay. So it's not like everyone was thinking, but you know, they were insulting the authorities and so they should get what's going to them. It was
Patrick, you're talking about a country where there's a law that says if you insult or attack any government or a member or the member of the family, you can go to jail. Seriously, who's going to criticize anything?
Yeah, but the interesting the interesting thing about this is that these people are intelligence officers from a foreign country. So it's not like regular people. They're not journalists. They're not anybody. They're intelligence officers. And a few months ago, the relationship between Qatar and the rest of I didn't catch that one. Okay. The tension got so high between Qatar and the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia and UAE, and I think Bahrain, these countries pulled out their ambassadors to Qatar. And a few weeks later, everybody got back together everything forgotten. And what I find interesting about this is that they waited until the sentence to pardon them. They didn't just like kill the news before it started. No, they waited for the sentence to be issued and then they were pardoned.
So it was probably trying to make a point as much of a point as you could have. And And I'm guessing there are economic interests there. There always are.
I'm not sure. Qatar is maybe the richest country in the world, but UAE is well off. They don't need...
Yeah. I guess. All right. Okay. Thanks very much. And we will close this roundtable with Brekkie and more depressing news. Or, yeah, I guess.
Well, we're basically moving from one part of the world to another. Ever since Russia moved into Georgia many years ago, there's been some expansionist movement from Russia. Let's just say expansionist, to use a friendly word. we're starting to notice it here in Sweden now. We're regularly getting flyovers or submarines coming very close to our borders and so on. It's like the Russians are, just testing the borders in the Baltic Sea. We're lucky that we don't share a border with them, but we only have Finland or Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania in between us and Russia. We're not a NATO country like Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are. And if you look at, for example, the map of the Baltic Sea, you're going to find this really weird place in between Lithuania and Poland called Kaliningrad, which is Russia, but it's not part of mainland Russia. It's this tiny little oblast out in the Baltic Sea. And they're within missile radius of Sweden, very comfortable missile radius even. So when Russia starts sending airplanes, bomber airplanes, to fly over Sweden, we naturally get a little bit worried here. Ever since the 80s, there's always been the, look out, the Russians are coming. There's always been that small little fear here. So what's been happening now recently is we've started, not fighting them, but, we're sending up our own jets to chase them off, to show that, you're encroaching on our borders. And this is something that happened just earlier this past week. Two Russian bombers were very uncomfortably close to our national borders. And we sent up two JAS-39 Gripen, our fighter planes, made in and by Sweden, to basically chase them off. And this seems to be having no diplomatic effects yet. Nobody's talking about this in terms of, foreign policy or anything. It's just, oh yeah, the Russians are a bit close, let's chase them off again. And I'm a bit worried to see what happens next, because I don't think, because Russia invaded Georgia back in the days, 2008. And then they signed a peace treaty and said, all right, we're going to leave Georgia. And then they went back in. And the rest of the world is all like, oh, Russia, you shouldn't do that. But we're not going to do anything because you're too big and powerful right now. And then they're doing this in Ukraine now, in the Crimea. And the entire world is going, oh, Russia, you shouldn't do that kind of thing. Shame on you.
Well, I think that it's being a little bit more uncomfortable this time with the Ukraine. But
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, much, much more. Because, Ukraine has, European-type relationships, while Georgia is just this tiny little country next to Armenia. Who cares about Georgia, at least here in the Western world? Nobody knows where Georgia is, even. Most people could still point to Ukraine on a map. But if you ask them to point to Georgia, they're just as likely to point at Turkey or Turkmenistan. They Georgia doesn't really figure into.
Would they
news.
Point at me? Why would they point at me?
because you're a big guy.
I didn't even catch that one. Well done. It's funny, it's something that. Obviously, because my wife cares about the news from Finland and the rest of the Nordic countries more than I would naturally. She, in the past couple of months, I would say, she's mentioned at least a couple of times the fact that either Finland or Sweden was trying to find a Russian submarine that was somewhere in. The Gulf or the archipelago near Helsinki.
Yeah, in the Baltic Sea and thereabouts. Because, they come out of St. Petersburg, obviously, which is just in that tiny little strait between Finland and Estonia. Right. So once they leave, they pass by Finland and Estonia, and then they're just right next to Stockholm.
Mm. And they're they were looking for them for several days. And obviously, for anyone who's seen The Hunt for Red October knows that a submarine can be very difficult to find. Right. And there were stories about, I'm guessing, the Swedish army and then the Finnish army trying to find that submarine to just even try to confirm that it was even there. right? Yeah. And so it's funny that we never hear about any of this in our countries, at least in, I haven't heard anything about this in France, but it is, it's always, as always with Russia, the question is, what are you playing at? What are you doing? We just don't understand what your end game is. And
I think I do understand it though. I think I do understand. They're continuously just pushing the border a little bit to see when the world's reaction is going to go, okay, Russia, now you've gone too far. I mean, can they move into Estonia? Can they move into Latvia? Will people care? What happens if they all of a sudden go to Minsk and say, oh yeah, Belarus, you used to be ours. You want to be ours again? I mean, there's already so many Russians here in Belarus. You might as well be ours. you know, it's the Crimean strategy again.
Right. I think that's the effect. I think what we don't understand is why. Because there is, you know, it's not just that Putin is thinking, oh, we're just going to get some more territory just for fun. And we're going to, there is a national motivation or Russian, you know, cultural heritage.
Why are you, economically denying them their fun, Patrick?
Yeah, well, I'm not denying anything. They can do whatever they want. I'm just trying to understand why they're, and it comes back to that idea that if you don't understand it, if you're completely unfamiliar with the cultural context and historical context and all of this, it's very difficult to understand. Because honestly, when you look at it like that, like we're looking at it now, meaning, you know, they're sending bombers over, you know, very closely to flirt with the border of Sweden, and they're sending submarines in the archipelago in Helsinki, and they're doing this and that.
Nothing wrong with it is a little flirtation.
It just sounds, it sounds not insane, but it sounds provocative and just for the sake of being evil. It sounds evil. It's like Putin is trying to see how far he can go to see how many other countries he can invade. And that's the image you get for, you know, it's like the evil dictator rubbing his hands and going like, now I'm going to send a submarine there
and if they don't react. Come on, it's just the Cold War coming back.
I'm not, and that's the easy explanation. Maybe that's it. But I'm not sure it's a little bit more complicated than that.
We used to make jokes and play around and say that when the United States went to Iraq, it was all about the oil, which, you know, to a certain extent was maybe a little bit true. But here, I think it's a lot about the oil, to be honest. The Russian financial system is in the gutter right now.
Right.
They are having so much problems. Their inflation is up. Their interest rates are up. I mean, the interest rates were up to 17 or 18 just a few weeks ago. Here in Sweden, our interest is negative. That's you know, that's the kind of difference we're talking about. We're actually at negative 0.25% here in Sweden. It's crazy. But so their financial system is in the dumps. And what do you do when you want to distract people from bad finances in a country? You go to war. You know,
that's the explanation that everyone is. But the problem is that is not doing. I mean, some people are saying that it's doing this to distract everyone from the horrendous economic situation till they fix it. And you know, they need a couple of years to do something about it. But things started before that. I mean, I do think maybe that's it. Maybe, again, that is kind of a easily packageable explanation. I'm not sure there isn't something. Even that seems a little bit weird to me. I'm not sure there isn't something else going on that is, you know, when I went to live in Japan, living in Japan and learning about the Japanese culture and history and all of this gave me a different outlook on what it means to be Japanese and the way they think and the way they see the world. And even though you can understand a lot of the Japanese history through a Western lens, I'm wondering if, you know, it changes your view on it when you learn about it more. And I'm wondering if Russia isn't one of those weird places where to really understand what's happening, you need to... it's more different than we think it is. It's more different from you know, the West than we think it is. There is something inherently different about the way Russians view not just the world, not just themselves, view everything. So I'm not being clear, but I think there's something there.
Sure, absolutely. I do understand what you mean. I've also spent a long time in Japan, and I've spent enough time in the Middle East and Africa to realize that, you know, you don't understand these countries just by reading a book and some news about them. If you've stayed for, you know, at least a week in a country, you start realizing that, yeah, there's more to this country than I've ever been able to just read about or, you know, learn about that way. You need to spend some time there. Mm. And Russia's definitely no exception. But still, I mean, over time, you start noticing trends in a country's foreign policy and their behavior towards other countries. And Russia has this, or at least has had for the past 8 years or so, this weird tendency to try to push their borders, and not just the country's borders, but, you know, the borders of what is acceptable, a little bit too far, and then move back just a little bit when the official reaction becomes too strong. And, you know, even though they might have taken 7 steps forward, they only take 2 steps back when people start saying, shame on you, Russia. Mm. So they do make, you know, a 5-step gain. Mm. And I don't know what needs to happen for them to stop doing this. And that's the thing.
That's a big question, isn't it?
Because there's lots of policy, both in Sweden and Finland at the moment, for those countries to join NATO. Because we need a stronger NATO border against Finland right now, against Russia. Finland is right now the weak link here, because it's the only NATO country bordering Russia in that way, or on that side of things.
And I can tell you that there is a huge debate happening in Finland right now on whether or not Finland should join NATO, because obviously there is a sort of comforting idea that if you join NATO, then you're free of the threat of Russia, because of course they're never going to attack NATO. But then there's a whole other bunch of people saying, you know what, we really should not poke the drunk bear. Mm. Let's just, joining NATO is just trying to piss them off. And we've always managed to manage Russia. There is no reason why this should change. We just show them that we're okay, we're ready to be firm if there's an issue, but we're not antagonistic. And so these two factions are fighting it out right now. Mahmoud, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was wondering, isn't Ukraine part of the NATO or not?
Ah, you're stumping me. Quick, someone.
Ukraine has relations with NATO. Yeah. They've applied all the way since back in 2008. They're considered to be NATO friendly, but not a member of NATO.
Because obviously if they were, there would be a duty for NATO to intervene. But
Just a quick addition there. There was a poll in October of 2014, not an official government poll or anything, but just a poll among the people. And more than half the population of Ukraine wants to join NATO at the moment.
Which is exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
And there's a strong possibility that this might have been what motivated Putin and Russia to push those boundaries to Ukraine, because Ukraine was going to try and ally itself very clearly and very strongly with the West, with NATO. And Russia obviously doesn't like that at all. So it comes back to the idea that, is it a good idea for Finland to try and get with NATO? There are a few bordering countries in, for Russia that are part of NATO. But of course, those joined when Russia was, in the 90s or maybe even early 2000s, when Russia was in disarray and couldn't do everything about it. Of course, now they're part of it. But
basically, every European country except Belarus and Ukraine that border Russia are members of NATO. Finland, Belarus, and Ukraine are the exceptions at the moment. So you got, Estonia,
Latvia, and Estonia.
So
yeah. Exactly. But they joined when Russia was completely unable to do anything about anything. So
sure.
That was the right time. If Finland had joined at that point, I think it would have been fine. But
I mean, Ukraine wanted to join earlier, but Viktor Yanukovych, he basically shelved the idea. He said that, no, we're going to be non-aligned.
Because he knows how things work with Russia.
Yep.
Anyway, it's a very interesting debate to have. And I will be able to report on the state of Russia very soon because I'm leaving for St. Petersburg next week. I think it's going to be super fun. St. Petersburg is a city that is obviously super interesting and culturally incredibly rich. And it's going to be super cool to finally visit it. I didn't love my time in Moscow. I went there twice, very briefly. But I think I'm going to really appreciate St. Petersburg.
It's a very nice place, yeah.
Yeah. Just to round up the discussion for the two very far away Middle Easterners, how foreign this discussion sounds to you, or not foreign at all?
We got our own worries here, Patrick.
You got what, sorry?
We got our own worries here.
Right.
You Europeans can fight it.
But, you know, it's funny. Russia is no more European. I mean, the large majority of Russia, maybe not the most inhabited places, but it's very much... an Eastern and Asian country.
Yeah.
Okay, but, you Asians and Europeans can fight it off. Us Arabs, we can fight together.
Yeah,
okay.
Because, I mean, Russia would have to go through Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Turkey, and the country, that is, and Iran, if they even want to get close to the Middle East.
Sure, yeah. But so I guess, just to confirm, it's not being discussed at all. Russia's... as it doesn't relate to issues of oil, it's not being discussed, right?
It's not everything about the goddamn oil, man. I hate that. I really hate. You know, like,
okay, fair enough.
Like, look, I live in Dubai, and Dubai has no oil.
Yeah,
no oil. You know, all of their wealth comes from tourism, finance, and import and exports. That's the fortune of Dubai. It has nothing to do with oil, at least in Dubai. But even like the Russian situation, it doesn't matter here. Not really.
Okay.
All right. Well, it does matter for the UAE because they're losing a lot of Russian tourists who are buying all the stuff. So the sales are lower this year than they usually are.
The Chinese are taking over.
They're taking over everywhere.
There's a lot of Chinese people. Mm.
So do you have luxury store clerks mainly being Chinese people now? Because in France, that's definitely the case. There are tons and tons of store clerks that are Chinese and that often don't speak French very well. If you go to the big department stores, you're going to have, in the very expensive luxury stores, many of them are going to be Chinese clerks.
I just bought a car 2 weeks ago, and the lady who sold it to me from the car company was Chinese. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. So confirmed. China is everywhere. I guess we didn't need this confirmation to make sure.
China's been very impressive in that way. However, I mean, they're slowly moving into so many places in the world, and they're doing it in a completely different way. I mean, back in the days when Europe went to Africa, it used to be like, hi, we're going to teach you about Christianity, and we're going to teach you about the right way to do business, and we're going to take all of your stuff, basically. That was the European way. Now China's going there and saying, hi, we got money, we've got stuff. Yeah. What do you have?
We can build things. You want something built? Yeah. We can build it.
Yeah. It's basically, we're not going to take your stuff, it's we're going to build your stuff, and
I mean, they're going there and saying, hi, we are Huawei. We want to give you all of these telephony switches, and we're going to leave 10 people here to maintain them for you.
Yeah. The entire case of China. I would love to have someone from China on the show, like from mainland China, to talk about all of this. And that could also be a very interesting special episode. I mean, when you talk about the way things are in the different country, the fact that there are, you know, what is it, a billion and a half people in the country now, just that fact makes it, the scale of everything is completely different from what we are used to. I mean, if you think of a large country like the US
or Iceland,
it's a small portion. No, but I mean in population.
Yeah, I know.
It's a small portion of the kind of issues that on top of, you know, the development issues and many others, but a small portion of the issues that China has as a country, as a government, as everything. So that would also be a very interesting topic to discuss. But alas, we have come to the end of this show. I think we've covered a good amount of topics. It was pretty cool, and we are going to leave one another with parting thoughts of where people can find us on the internet if they want to hear more. And let's start with the very prolific Brekkie Thomasson.
Sure. You'll find all of my stuff on CSICON.net. That's CSICON.net. It's the podcasting network that I launched in 2011 and is the home of all of my shows and I think 7 or 8 other shows that I'm not even on. If I could just recommend one of them, I would recommend Geek Days. It's a daily tech news show, tech and entertainment and gaming, basically. Every morning, and I say morning European time, so it's in the middle of the night in America and early afternoon in Asia. But we every morning, we release a 10 to 15 minute show about just the latest news and a couple of opinions on those news. So Geek Days, look it up where podcasts are sold.
Excellent. Geek Days it is. And just to confirm, your full name is Brekkie Thomasson.
Yes.
Is your dad's name Thomas and that's why it's Thomasson?
Yes, it was. Yes.
So
and his surname was Svensson because his father's name was Sven.
How does that even work?
Very well,
it's
thank
crazy.
You.
Crazy. It's insane. How do you find people? I guess you have the app to know if they're...
There's the app. But also you find people by saying, are you Thomas Svensson? Yeah, I am. So your father was Sven? Which Sven was he? He was Sven Paulsen. Oh, okay. Yeah, that guy. He was Paul Nielsen's son, wasn't he? Yes, he was.
It's
Iceland is small enough that this becomes that quite works, simple. Right? Yeah, mm-hmm. You're only dealing with 300,000 people.
That is insane.
You guys are just making me here smile like crazy. You should visit the Middle East. Seriously, guys.
Oh,
everybody knows. Everybody knows everybody, and they're all linked in what to through families.
Know,
even with 20 million Saudis, they all know each other, and they're linked in one way or another through the family.
Well, so, I spent a week in Saudi. It was great.
I don't know. I'm sure I've mentioned it at least once, but you know, I was born in Lebanon, right? Turkey.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that.
And it's funny because my dad has exactly that kind of conversation with everyone that he meets that is from Lebanon. It's basically like, oh, you're this guy from that place, and you go, oh, your brother was from here, and he's and of course, and it's like, oh yes, I went to school with his cousin, and yeah, it's very funny. It happens. It's like, you know, it's there is a diaspora of Lebanese people all over the world. It's how does it work that every single one of them is somehow linked to some member of your family? It's very funny.
Oh, come on, Patrick, you should see when I got married. I didn't know Manal's at all, her family, never met her before.
Yeah.
And only to find out that we actually almost met face to face and we're connected through different, least four.
Your wife,
four,
you mean?
Yeah, four ways. Her cousin turned out to be engaged to my cousin. They turned out, her family turned out to be former neighbors to my aunt, my mom's sister.
It's weird. It's just, I don't understand how that works.
Her brother turned out to be classmates to my cousins.
That is pretty cool.
And this is a 5 million population city.
it's a small world.
Yeah. It's another one of those mysteries of how does all of this work. It's like, you know, the naming system in Iceland. It's just we don't understand it. We just accept it.
Well, six degrees of connection thing they have. I think in Saudi it's only 3 degrees and you'll find
The Icelandic naming system is not really all that strange. I mean, in the Arab world, you have the Nasab, the
Abu
you know, Ibn something.
No, yeah. So a lineage, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it might be the father's name, or in some cases, the name of a remote ancestor, like Ibn Khaldun or something.
Well, maybe it's a different pronunciation, or but Abu something is the father.
It's
a nickname.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So okay.
Same with in Hebrew, also has the Ben something.
Right. Yeah, that's true. All right. So Brecky is Psycon Network with Geek Days. Turkey, where are you these days?
Well, you can find me on Twitter when I'm posting there. And my ID is at Turkey Albella. That's TurkiAlbella.
Thank you. Mahmoud, what about you?
I'm also on Twitter at Sunzo83. That's SunZo83.
So is it, where does it come from? Is it? It's not Sunzu, right?
It's been an online nickname for ages.
Oh, okay.
Like everywhere I use it. So
okay.
It comes from Sun Tzu, the art
right.
of war.
But yeah. No, that's what
without the TSO, it's a ZO.
Oh, that's what I thought. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Excellent. All right. Thank you very much to all three of you. I think it was a really cool conversation. For me, it's Patrick. No, it's not Patrick. So complicated on Twitter. not Patrick on Twitter. You can find this show on FrenchSpin.com. You can also find it. You can also find another show about video games called Pixels. And you can support the show on Patreon. It's patreon.com/TheFiliusClub, I believe. Yes, I always forget whether it's the Phileas Club or Phileas Club, but it is the Phileas Club. Over 100 people, almost 150 people support the show, and I am incredibly thankful for that support. If you think the show is cool, if you think it brings something to your day or to your month, then you can go there and support it. I would very much appreciate it. We have a milestone at $500 per episode where we would do specials, maybe once a trimester, more or less, with conversations with one person to delve into one topic and or to try and learn a little bit more about their environment and culture. I have a few ideas about what we could do, and we'll see if that happens. But we're not quite there yet, but we're the amount is rising every month. So if you think that could be a cool idea, please think about, consider going to patreon.com/TheFiliusClub and contributing to this show as well. I'm sure you dear listener, already contribute to a bunch, and we are very thankful for all of your patronage. Next month, I'm not 100% sure there's going to be a show. As I mentioned, I'm going to be traveling to Russia next week, and then I'm going to be spending a bunch of time in Finland, hoping and praying that the Russian subs and bombers don't suddenly get crazy ideas. But I'm going to be in the Finnish countryside with a very good internet connection, so my shows should keep coming. But at the end of the month, I was thinking about maybe taking a couple of weeks of full, complete vacation, and I'm not sure there's going to be a show. Maybe I'll do something alone, a shorter show. I don't know. We'll see. But if that doesn't happen, we'll be, of course, back after that in July. That's it for this show. Thank you so much again to Brecky, Turkey, and Mahmoud, and to all of you listening and contributing and supporting the show. And we will be back for the next episode, either in June or in July. Thanks a lot. Talk to you then. Bye. I am going to run and edit the show as I always do, because I have to finish all of this before the Eurovision Song Contest final starts.
Sure,
God, that
stuff.
Horrible thing. Do you actually watch it?
Yes.
Everybody does.
Wow.
Everybody does, of course.
It's so horrible, man.
No, it's fine. You know, that's the thing. I think it was done seriously at the very beginning, but now it's just people make fun of it, and it's fun to be all together and to make fun of it.
Oh, so it's like a comedy show. You watch it for the comedy.
I think only a very tiny fraction of the people watching it take it seriously. Mm. It's just, you know, who will have the craziest hair and who will have the most...
the craziest, you know, beard.
Yeah, for example. Or, you know, using the wind machine or... And it's funny to see all the countries, like, going nuts for their own contestant. And no, it's not... I don't think anyone watches it seriously. But for some reason, the Scandinavians love it to bits.
Yeah.
And but it's not serious there either, right, Brekkie?
No, I wouldn't say serious at all. I mean, every Scandinavian country wants their own person to win, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more the spectacle, more the fun.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. It's the same. Well, here not a huge amount of people watch it, but those who do, that's how they watch it. So
sure.
And we're gonna do that with friends that are coming over for a Eurovision Song Contest party. So
good fun.
So a lot of drunk people.
Well, four more. I don't drink, so I'm not going to be drunk. But the others might.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.